Good evening. Welcome to WPFW 89.3 FM here in Washington, D.C. My name is Garland Nixon, and I'm here with
Mark Levine.
And you're listening to News Views. News Views is on every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. We talk about all of the latest news stories that are important and try to find things that maybe you haven't heard or things that are very important. I imagine we're going to have to be shortly talking about the findings from the Supreme Court.
Absolutely.
That won't be. I imagine within the next couple of weeks, we're going to have to talk about that on the show.
Yeah, well, the oral argument occurred this week. The findings probably won't happen until June.
Yeah, so, but that's coming, and that's going to be some, that'll be some interesting shows. We'll have to get some really good guests, some really good guests in for that. But today, we're talking about an article, that was in the Washington Post here a few days ago, and I believe we have with us Mr. Fred Tutman. Are you there, Fred?
Yeah, I'm right here on the line.
And Fred is the river keeper for the Patuxent River, and he has an interesting article called Within Mainstream Environmentalist Groups, Diversity is Lacking. An excellent article that applies to other groups, but basically what they're talking about is environmental groups that that aren't inclusive. They don't have diversity, and as a result of not having diversity, they don't necessarily address a lot of the issues that some of the minority communities are concerned with. So let's start with Mr. Tutman. Fred, I'm sure all of our listeners want to know exactly what a riverkeeper is. What is the Patuxent River riverkeeper?
So I'm a guardian for the state of Maryland's longest and deepest intrastate river. It runs 110 miles through seven counties. The riverkeepers are licensed by a group in New York City, and there are about 200 of us worldwide, each one of us responsible for a particular waterway. We advocate, we're community organizers, we litigate against polluters, mm-hmm. try to get better laws to protect the waterways.
Oh, that's interesting. Great.
Is there one person in charge of the Mississippi? I'm just curious. Or does that get several people?
Oh, there are a bunch of folks down the Mississippi and the Gulf.
I was going to say, that'd be a long river to be in charge of, the entire Mississippi River.
Yeah, some of these are bifurcated. Like, there's an upper and a lower James River in Virginia. At various times, there have been people on the upper and the lower of the Susquehanna.
Well, I want to know who's in charge of the Potomac, because it's awfully polluted, and I have a word to say to them.
Yeah, well, actually, there is a very good Potomac riverkeeper. He's relatively new. The founding riverkeeper retired in January of this year. So the guy who's on the Potomac is just getting up to speed, but he's very up to the job.
They're always warning me I can't swim in this beautiful river outside of Washington, D.C., because it's really dangerous. And so I assume that one of the roles for riverkeeper is to try to keep people from dumping pollutants upstream that float downstream next to people like me.
Well, yeah, we're trying to also build a buzz. We're trying to get other people involved in this task of saving and protecting these wonderful rivers that people love, that people feel connected to. Like you said, you feel connected to the Potomac.
Well, you know, your article is a very important article for a number of reasons that we're going to be able to discuss tonight, today. But it was a Washington Post article, Within Mainstream Environmentalist Groups, Diversity is Lacking. And for starters, I understand you are the only black riverkeeper or African-American, whatever term someone chooses to use, worldwide of all the riverkeepers, is that correct?
Well, yeah, with the important distinction that's African-American. There's an African riverkeeper in Senegal.
Okay,
and
sure.
There are other people of color. There are people who have tribal ancestry around. But African-American is a distinction.
Yes.
And that's what they tell me.
Okay. Yes, yes, yes. A big discussion on the whole black African-American here in this country, those terms, but that's a whole nother show. But this one, so I understand that in looking at this article, you know, I picked up that there is a bit of frustration, you know, within the African-American environmentalist community. There's a bit of frustration with the lack of diversity and some of the issues that lack of diversity creates within the larger, predominantly white environmentalist groups. What is that frustration about? Tell me about it, how it came about.
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, certainly there's the question of whether there's inclusiveness in the hiring practices of mainstream environmental groups. But I think, at least more to my area of concern, is that the work being done by large, well-funded mainstream groups doesn't particularly touch or benefit communities of color or poor communities in the same way that they tend to serve very empowered and environmentally well-off folks. You know, in the Chesapeake Bay, the constituents of the well-funded organizations tend to be range from waterfront land dwellers, people who sail and you know, have access in a particular way, a sense of entitlement to natural resources. There's a real disconnect, I think, between where the worst problems are in the environment and where the bulk of the focus is for the large mainstream groups. I would argue that the mainstream groups tend to serve the 1%, mm-hmm. or at least the folks who are major donors. Mm-hmm. You know, grassroots folks are doing different work, and I think people of color are doing grassroots work in their own communities. They're on their own, frankly, because there's no rescue in sight for the, you know, these massive toxic hazards that disproportionately affect communities of color.
Mr. Tuttle, I'd be curious about who, or if there is, a riverkeeper for the Anacostia River. Of course, Washington, D.C. is founded on the banks of two rivers, the Potomac and the Anacostia, but the Anacostia goes through southeast, goes through Prince George's County. It goes through a you know, some heavily African American areas, and I'd be curious, Mr. Tutman, if that river at least, which would have dramatic concerns to African American communities in this area, whether there's a river keeper there.
There's absolutely a very effective river keeper on the Anacostia, very engaged with the communities that he serves, very concerned about environmental justice. There's actually a heritage of several water keepers have served on the Anacostia. And the latest, I say, I think, would be certainly among the, you know, among the folks who really do care about this stuff.
I'd just be surprised that if it's a white person, just because the communities that largely live around the Anacostia tend to be black. Not that that's not a good person, but I'd be surprised that, particularly in rivers that go through heavily black communities, you would think that people from those communities would want to serve as waterkeepers.
Sure. Well, the current serving waterkeeper on the Anacostia happens to be white. There have been others in the past that were not on the Anacostia. But I tend to approach these issues more as have and have not. I don't think they're really black and white.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are questions of power and those who have power and who do not. I think there are questions of grassroots versus those who are working from the ground up as opposed to those who are working from the top down.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's much more meaningful because it's hard to generalize. Like, I can't say with authority that black environmentalists all think a certain way, no more than I could say that about white environmentalists. It just depends.
One of the important things that comes out in this article, and it's a term I heard you use a moment ago, and that is environmental justice. You know, there is environmental groups. There are environmental groups, and the ones that are geared, the ones that have a very significant minority presence tend to be environmental justice, and they tend to look at things differently. One of the things that I picked up in the article that maybe you can expound upon a bit was that the mainstream environmental groups tend to look at, you know, let's have clean water, let's have clean air, let's save the old growth forest, et cetera. And some of the issues that I saw, the environmental justice, organizations that were significantly mostly people of color, there's two particular things that stood out here. That they dealt with. And one of them was, it says Robert Buller of Texas Southern University said that in 1980, all five of Houston's landfills were in minority communities, as were six of the city's eight incinerators. He said mainstream environmental groups he approached for help did not seem concerned. It says the environmental justice movement started with a battle in Warren, North Carolina in 1982. The state selected a largely black township as a site for a landfill to dump more than 30,000 cubic yards of soil contaminated with polychlorinated biphenyls, most people know as PCBs.
Yeah.
It said the residents lost, and minority environmentalists said they never forgot that mainstream conservation groups did not help. Now, and I don't want this, you know, of course all of us, we don't want this to be, let's beat up on the environmental groups, because we are all very much in favor and supportive of what they're doing. But I do see an issue here where there are some other concerns, the environmental concerns, that without a significant diverse presence, an environmental group may not look at, you know, the plights of maybe poor people or black people, et cetera, who are dealing with some slightly different environmental concerns or unique environmental concerns for our community, if you would.
Well, sure. I agree with everything you said. I think that environmental organizations that are funded, they work on what funds them. And the funding of people who have lots of resources, the donors who have lots of resources, have a whole different idea circumstantially about what an environmental problem is. If you're poor or if you're black in America, I assure you, your circumstances matter quite a bit in terms of what the environment is for you. I think large mainstream groups think of the environment typically as raw nature, so they're busily saving, again, waterfronts and mountains and national parks and, you know, places that are relatively pristine. I think communities of color are often hanging on for dear life because they're on the, they're dealing with an onslaught of toxic hazards and unfair practices that selectively are very particularly affect these communities of color. So the environmental mainstream movement, I think, tries very hard to be colorblind. And that's a little absurd because the culture we live in is not colorblind when it comes to where the pollution goes. Your lifespan, your longevity is actually influenced as much by the zip code and where you live than whether or not you recycle and, you know, do all these very voluntary practices on your own.
So let's take the example that Garland just gave of landfills in Houston. So I presume, and if I'm wrong, please correct me, but I presume that there's no way out of a landfill, that every community needs a landfill, that toxic PCBs have to go somewhere. And maybe they don't. And if they don't, please inform me of that. But it seems to me that you're always going to have a landfill. And usually the corporate interests are going to go for the cheapest land possible, and the cheapest land is in the poorest neighborhood. That's not a good thing, to be sure, but should they go in uninhabited areas? Is that what you're arguing, or do you actually think we can get rid of landfills entirely?
No, I'm saying that the political quantum of where a noxious land use goes. They don't go in Potomac, Maryland, all right? They don't go in wealthy, empowered areas. They go in areas where people have relatively less power to influence what goes in their community. So every community does not have a landfill. In fact, some communities, many communities, would rather ship their waste elsewhere, anywhere but here. And that's where the whole term NIMBY, you know, comes from.
Right, not in my backyard. Mm-hmm. But is there a place, like, could we ship them all? I don't know. I think of Nevada because I think of that as mostly empty desert, apart from Las Vegas and a few cities. But then I remember when we wanted to ship our nuclear waste to Nevada, Nevadans were like, well, we don't want it here. I guess my question is sort of a practical one. Assuming it has to go somewhere, how should a society fairly determine where it goes? I mean, there are people who are internationalists. They would say ship it to Bangladesh, but That's not fair to the people in Bangladesh.
Well, let me throw something in there, and that is there's one very significant issue also that arises, and that's money. Because if you are shipping the trash over long, long distances, needless to say, the cost of trash removal goes through the roof, which, of course, is going to be another issue.
So I guess that's my question, yeah. Mr. Tupman. What would be your fair solution to what seems to be the problem of nobody wants it in their backyard?
I think any community has to have some deliberative way of assigning how land gets used and where certain land uses get put, the same way they'd consider where libraries and schools and other man-made infrastructure go.
Yep.
What I'm pointing out is that deliberative process tends to break down when it involves communities without power.
Yeah, and let me, for both of you may not know this, but there was a time in my earlier years where I worked with the state of Maryland, Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, worked on loan with them, and I did investigations. We investigated toxic waste dumping, illegal toxic waste dumping, and all the toxic removal sites, etc. And there are some hard and fast criteria that can be used, such as, if you have an area that's very sandy, where the waste material are more likely to leach through that sand to the aquifer, et cetera, as opposed to an area where it's hard clay land and it's less likely. So if you look at an area and say, well, you know, the area, they can use criteria that have nothing to do with the community or the political power. They can look at the type of ground and say, well, we're going to put landfills or toxic materials or wherever, where there is clay or hard rock or something, where it's less likely to be a problem. And I think one of the things that you see is those types of objective criteria kind of melt away, and it comes down to, well, you know, we may have a lot more clay in our land, but, you know, houses are selling for $2.8 million.
Nobody wants it in their backyard. That's why even the example of Nevada that I gave that example because it's mostly empty desert, but Nevadans don't want it either. I just see it as a lose-lose battle where everyone fights to say, not me.
Let me ask Mr. Tupman a question. I think one of the things that you're getting at in this article is this. the discussion that we're having is a valid discussion. But because the mainstream environmental groups don't have diversity, if they had people of color, and not just people of color, we're talking class.
Socioeconomic, yeah, poor people.
If they had poor people, people of color, et cetera, with inculcated within their organizations, this discussion would be had, but because there is not diversity in either class or race or ethnicity, et cetera, they're not having these conversations. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Well, yes, and bingo. And I think the flip side of this is it's not uncommon for mainstream environmentalists, typically white, to come up to me and say, look, we've been inviting black folks to these meetings for years and they don't show up. They don't come. So they must not be environmentalists. Which strikes me as kind of bizarre, because all of the communities that I work with, white, color, white, black, whatever, everybody's interested in the environment. I think the forum of where you bring your concerns matters greatly in terms of, again, relative power. If you have to go to a meeting in someone else's community, if you're on terrain that is uneven at its face, mm-hmm. If you're going to be indoctrinated rather than listened to, then I think that there's less of a likelihood that the communities will come together and work in unison as a team on these issues. But it's just bizarre for me to constantly hear that black folks don't care about the environment. I don't know anybody who doesn't care about the environment.
I think you should respond to them. I got a great place in Anacostia or Baltimore or a bunch of areas I can think of in this country, Prince George's County, Maryland. Let's host the meeting there, and yes. Let's see who shows up.
And well, the other part of it is, and I think this is important, and you know, this is not just, I mean, within environmental groups, but within, there are a number of, and I've spoken about this with friends of mine before, and some people on the Hill. There are a number of groups, left-leaning groups, groups on the left, that while they are mean well and they have great intentions, they don't have diversity within the staff, particularly at the highest levels. They don't have African Americans, very few working with the organizations, and they really have virtually no one in a decision-making, on a decision-making level, on an administrative level. So you don't have people who are comfortable saying, let's invite these people to be part of the organization. Let's have a diversity in the people who make the decisions as to what we're going to address and who talk about everything, rather than just saying, let's have a meeting with this 99% white organization that is the entire administrative staff is white. Let's bring some black people in there and listen to them and then send them about their merry way.
Well, yes, and I agree. Let's be clear. If these mainstream groups were heavily populated by people of color, I assure you the work that they would be doing, the issues, the priorities, would be substantially different. And I think that's an unwelcome feature. I think we're welcome to the table to the extent that we present diversity, the appearance of inclusiveness. But at the point we start lobbying and arguing for refocusing of the issues on those matters that particularly affect communities of color, I think that scene is disingenuous. It's seen as competing for the resources. The issue that is very hot right now, one of the issues that's very hot in the Chesapeake Bay area, is pollution trading, right? So, which on its face strips environmental wealth from one community and allocates it elsewhere. And there's a lot of buy-in amongst the mainstream movement of why pollution trading is good money-raising and all this stuff. But inevitably, if you're trading something, A, that doesn't belong to you in the first place, but also you're creating a marketplace for where people can pay for the privilege of polluting, I assure you that that pollution is going to go in those communities least able to fight back, least able to resist it. And the credit, the wealth generated by the trade, will inevitably go to those empowered communities that actually aren't that off to begin with. So that's an example of a situation where the demographics of a movement completely skews, completely changes its perspective on where the problems are, what the priorities need to be.
Mr. Tubman, if I could continue the river metaphor here, you swam upstream. I mean, you are the only African-American riverkeeper. You're clearly standing out and protecting the Patuxent River in a mostly white environment. How is it that you believe that you managed to, well, infiltrate's too strong a word, but let's just say make the riverkeepers in this circumstance, this environmental organization, more diverse? And what can people learn from your experience in terms of opening it up to others?
Well, I try pretty hard in my work to serve all of the communities. I don't look at a community and say, oh, there's a black community, I'm going to work harder for those guys. That's just not how my mind works. I do think that my perspective as an African-American with strong cultural ties to the earth, I grew up on a family farm, you know, did all the Boy Scout hiking, backpacking, all that stuff too. But I do believe that my particular slice of it is very context rich, because I believe that African-Americans have a particular heritage of connection to land in America. It's not one that's recognized often enough by, I think, mainstream groups, because it doesn't look like recreational stuff. It doesn't look like skiing and sailing and all that stuff.
Looks like farming, sharecropping.
Exactly. It's toil on land and being in touch with the rhythms of the earth. And that's a beautiful thing. That's a very rich, layered heritage that I think we have, that I think some African-Americans have lost sight of.
Well,
they lost touch of as a practical matter.
Another thing I think that is important about that, that I think we need to touch, kind of get back to very briefly, about the discussion of the effect that diversity has in an organization, the effect that it has, that diversity, whether it's race, ethnicity, et cetera, a gender, brings diversity of thought. And the reason I thought about that is because it's not like African Americans are saying we want to take over this environmental club, you know, organization and change everything they're doing. Basically, what it sounds like to me, such as with the Chesapeake Bay issues, I think one of the things that we are saying as African Americans, and African American people are saying, is that if there was diversity, if there were more African American people within the mainstream groups, when they made decisions such as how do we decide where things are going to go? How do we decide what we're going to support, or what we're going to support, where things should be, or how things should work? That they would have someone there saying, well, one of the considerations you should take when deciding your position is this. African Americans have this, and we're concerned that if this happens, all this stuff's going to be dumped on our community. So when you're making your decisions, take into account that if you do this, 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 or move in this direction, it's possible that the powers that be may just dump them all in our community. So I think one of the things that we're getting at here is diversity of thought brings diversity of opinion, and it brings to light the concerns of people, not necessarily just changing the entire direction of an environmental group, but it will bring to light different concerns that they're not able to address now because they don't have anyone saying these things to them.
Yes, I totally believe that you're right about that. I believe that there are social expectations attached to who we are identified as culturally. I know, because I've been working on the Appalachian Trail for 14 years, and when I walk along the trail, and there are a bunch of white environmentalists or trail workers in front of me who don't know me, they often, as I used to think was a courtesy, like, oh, why don't you go walk ahead, you know, they'll say. And I began to realize that actually some folks are really uncomfortable with an unknown black guy walking along behind them out in the wilderness. They think that's something really edgy about that.
Oh,
but
wow.
I also know that it's tough to talk about race stuff. Right? Because people will think you're paranoid, or you're playing the race card, or you're creating divisiveness. But let's be clear, I think we are divided. I think the nation is divided in so many ways around class and about race and perspective.
And yeah, it sounds like, and also what you're saying is this is a way to bridge those divides, to bring them together, to bring people together. And the other thing about race and class is this, and I didn't really get into this a lot, but within the article, that's one of the things you talk about, and that is a lot of the mainstream environmental groups. You know, not only are they, you know, majority white groups, but they're people of significant means, shall we say.
And I do think it's a class issue. Yeah. I think there are a lot of black people that are too busy struggling against, you know, socioeconomic pressures, just trying to make a living, or working in unions to do that, or working in NAACP or other organizations. My question was whether there are certain environmental groups, maybe in African-American churches or as part of, say, the NAACP or something, where there's already sort of an institution of African-American environmentalists that could rejoin the Sierra Club if those groups are out there. They could combine and work together. Is there anything like that that's out there?
Well, yeah, there are all kinds of groups who are doing, I guess, outreach. Of course, the analogy I made earlier was missionaries. There are quite a number of them that are trying to get people of color on their bandwagon, which is how the funding mechanisms work too, right? Somebody writes a grant, they want to do outreach, they want to convert people. there are far fewer opportunities for folks who want to absorb the agendas that already exist within communities, what I call compassionate environmentalism, environmentalism that helps people and communities as opposed to kind of nebulous issues that you can't touch, you know, climate change, which obviously is very, very important. But it doesn't touch people in quite the same way as something happening in their front yard or in their immediate community.
Right. So,
for example, I just say that if there's an Anacostia Neighborhood Association that's worried about the pollution, and Anacostia used to be one of the most polluted rivers in the country, I think it's actually getting a little bit better now. But maybe that neighborhood organization could join hands with the Sierra Club and work together. Is that possible?
And I think one of the things that's saying, if I may, Fred, I think one of the things that's being said here is that, that's articulated in this article, is that a number of African American environmental organizations started, and the reason they started was because they didn't want separate groups. They wanted to be a part of the mainstream groups. They wanted to join in as members of these various groups and be part of the groups, but they found that the door was slammed on them, that they weren't really brought in, and in many instances, African American professionals didn't, you know, get hired by them, and they felt that they were on the outside, and they created African American environmental groups out of necessity because they felt. Is that kind of the way it happened, Fred?
Well, yeah, that's my take on it as well. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what the deal is. But don't overlook, again, the distinction, again, between groups that serve communities, and I consider those to be grassroots, and groups that serve an issue. Mm-hmm. Right, they're polarized or focused entirely on a single issue, so they don't want anything to do with you if you're not interested in the same issue.
Mm-hmm.
Right, there's a whole cadre of folks within the Bay Area, for example, that care nothing about you unless you care about the Chesapeake Bay. So you're irrelevant, you're invisible, you're off the grid as far as they're concerned if you don't care about the same things. And but again, the point is your circumstances sometimes realistically influence exactly what you care about.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge. That's huge. You cannot ignore someone's circumstances. Of course, in the general society, a lot of folks assume that you're responsible for your own circumstances. So poor people live in really bad places because they didn't work hard, right? Because they don't get up and pick up the trash. I mean, these are, I think, very absurd. I'm being facetious.
They are absurd.
Right.
But the idea is that sometimes people don't have control over their circumstances.
Of course.
So the reason they may not seem to care about the environment is because they have a really lousy environment to begin with.
Right. And it certainly sounds to me like these are things that need to be addressed. And I think it's good that we're talking about it on this show, because I'm sure there may be people listening to this show in the environmental movement who feel offended. I'm guaranteeing there's somebody out there who feels offended or who feels attacked when, in fact, what's being said here is something that that can strengthen the environmental movement, that when whoever it is, the Sierra Club, because here's what I hear, two things. I hear that there's a mainstream environmental movement that deals with the environment in a broad spectrum of ways. And there's another environmental group that deals with people and how they are affected in a negative way on a more, you know, personal level. And that, that I think the inference I'm getting from this article is that people of color and people of lesser means are saying, we don't want to have to be on the outside. Can't we be a part of these organizations? And these organizations can still focus on what they focus on, but they can use their considerable means to also take a part or a small part to focus on the other issues that deal with people. Also,
well, yeah, and as you can imagine, people get very hot under the collar if they presume that what I'm saying is that the work of mainstream groups isn't important or isn't worthwhile. And that's actually not what I'm saying. I'm saying that it's not the same work
right.
as grassroots groups are inclined to do, and that we don't all benefit in exactly the same way from activities that improve clean air and clean water.
Let me stop you for a minute here. We're going to have to take a break. We're at halfway through the hour. You're listening. We'll be right back. Hold tight there, Fred. We're talking with Fred Tutman, who has had an article in the Washington Post, "Within Mainstream Environmental Groups, Diversity is Lacking." You're listening to 89.3 WPFW here in Washington, D.C. Garland, Nixon, and Mark Levine. We're here on News Views. It's on every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. Hold on there, Fred. And once again, let me give out the number, 202-588-0893. 202-588-0893. We want to hear from you. We'll be back in a minute.
Hi, I'm Ephraim Woolfolk, area bassist, teacher, and supporter of WPFW. And you're tuned in to member-supported WPFW Washington.
He might have. Welcome back to News Views. Are you there, Fred?
Yep, right here.
Okay, my name's Garland Nixon, and I'm here with
Mark Levine.
And you're listening to News Views 89.3 FM, WPFW, Washington, D.C., your local Pacifica affiliate. And we're talking about the environmental movement and the mainstream environmental movement, which, again, as we said, one of the issues that I think we haven't thrown out, really discussed is a lot of these mainstream environmental organizations have considerable resources. They get big dollars from these, and not only that, they have considerable power on Capitol Hill. They have lobbyists, etc. And some of these issues that face people of lesser means and people of color would be very easy for them to address and change. And it wouldn't. They wouldn't have to. You know, they wouldn't have to completely change everything they're doing. Just devote a small portion of their resources and administrative power to work with them. Not only that, let me bring another thing in, Fred. Not only that, they would bring in an entire new group of people. They would bring in a lot more people who are on the ground, so they would have a larger number of people to work with.
Well, yes, but the implications of doing social justice work it's a lot more controversial than picking up trash and cleaning up water and protecting air. So there's a suggestion maybe that the reason these groups have lots of resources is because they have been silent, I think, on social justice matters, right? They can attract more money, we're talking about clean air, than they can about struggling underserved communities.
Well,
right?
We're going to go to the phones in a second.
I was just going to say, I think you could combine the two issues, that they shouldn't be seen as one or the other. You could talk about clean water in an underserved community, clean air in an underserved community, that there might be strength in numbers, not just in numbers of people, but in numbers of issues. I don't blame anyone who's concerned about the Chesapeake Bay because they live on the Chesapeake Bay. That's fine. Just like I don't blame anyone who lives on the Anacostia River that's concerned about the Anacostia River. But there's strength if everyone who lives close or near or likes to have fun or fish or play in a waterway, if they all join together about keeping all waterways clean, I just think there's strength in numbers.
And it's important to talk about this because, you know what's important about it? Because it's probably making people uncomfortable. And if you're making people uncomfortable, it has been my experience, if people are uncomfortable, there's room. That's when they're growing. We've got Steve on line one. Steve, welcome to WPFW, and thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you very much, Garland. I just want to say, first off, love the show. It's a Friday night ritual with me and my almost 2-year-old son when I'm getting him ready for bed. We really enjoy the show and the great topics, very provocative.
Thank you.
I hope your son likes us, too. I'm not sure he understands all the issues, but maybe he does.
No, he doesn't, but getting him an early start, you know, when accidents.
That's true.
But, I think you really touched on a very important topic here. And I just wanted to say this, to me, this is a much broader issue than just the environmental movement. I think this affects advocacy groups with healthcare, mm-hmm. with nutrition, with food safety that I've certainly seen in my own life as well. I think what this really represents is a change that happened really in the 1970s. It was really the rise of the D.C.-based advocacy group. Prior to that time, most national advocacy groups were built around the state affiliate, the chapter-level concept, the grassroots, you know, president, vice president, people, you know, walking the precinct, you know, walking the church, you know, kind of getting, kind of that grassroots thing going. But in the 70s, you know, we really saw the rise, you know, with this D.C.-based, you know, kind of consulting class, and certainly the rise of these D.C.-based groups. Many of these groups, you mentioned partnering with local groups, they don't have any infrastructure to do that. They don't have, a state chapter. They don't have a local chapter. Basically, all they want out of the members, quote-unquote members, is people to write a check, after they get a direct mail thing in the mailbox or, you know, sign an online petition. I'm involved in, you know, the public health community, and I see this with our national organizations. They don't want the unpolished, rank and file getting involved. You know, they want the D.C.-based, you know, smooth-talking, Ivy League credentialed class, doing all of the communicating. Well, and I just want to make one more comment.
Certainly.
This is so much more class-based, I think, than race. My wife went to the Yale School of the Environment, I know this from having gone to law school. There are hundreds of people applying for every one of these jobs at groups like the Sierra Club or the NRDC. I mean, it's just bulletproof, elites wall to wall to get even your foot in the door there, even the mailroom.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. Brilliant, brilliant call. I certainly appreciate that, and thanks for listening. We're going to try to get some of these callers. We have some great callers, Fred, so we're going to try to get some of these callers. We want to hear what they have to say, and then we can discuss that. We've got who's next? Persona, thank you. Welcome to WPFW.
Hey. You ready for me?
Yes, we are.
Go ahead, Persona.
Okay, how you doing?
We're good. Great. Thank you for calling.
Hey, I just heard the show. I just got off of work, and I'm so amped by this show. I'm just finding out about it. And I just wanted to let you guys know, I'm actually a teacher and an activist in the community, and we work to put on an event every month to spread awareness about a range of issues. And we would love it if you guys, Mr. Dixon and if you guys could come and speak this month. Our theme is actually awareness of the connections and responsibility we have to the earth on an interdependent, historical, and even deeply spiritual level. And I would love it if you guys could, speak on what you guys are talking about right now, because it's so important. It's over at Soul 57, April 20th from 12 to 3:45. If y'all are available, I would love, for the community to, meet you guys and hear your perspectives.
Well, let me give you my email address, and it's Garland. I don't know if you're in a position to write it down. It's garlandin@gmail.com. Are you in a position to write that down? And certainly any of my listeners can contact me anytime, but are you in a position to write that down?
I do. And what was it again?
It's Garlandin. My name is Garland Nixon, and it's my name and then the first letter of my last name, garlandin@gmail.com. Send me an email, garlandin@gmail.com, and I'll get back with you, and hopefully we'll be able to work that out.
And I'm Mark, M-A-R-K, at marklevinetalk.com. You can also find me on Facebook, Mark Levine, or I'm on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk, MarkLevineTalk. And I'm definitely interested. So just shoot me an email, a Twitter, a tweet, or follow me on Facebook, and we'll chat.
And we'll get in touch with Fred and see if he wants to do it. And
if Mr. Tupman's around, that's such a crucial role he's playing, and for everybody to meet him, that would be great. Yeah, all three of you guys would be wonderful.
Thank you. And next caller? We've got Steve. Steve, welcome to WPFW.
Steve? Yes, this is Mike.
Oh, Mike. Mike. Oh, sorry, Mike.
Go ahead, Mike. Steve. Apologize. Go ahead.
Yes, first of all, I'd like to thank Fred Tutman for the great work that he does, and WPFW for putting issues like this on the air generally that aren't covered in any other media. But I would like to amplify a little bit on what Fred said. That grassroots efforts many times are edgy because they aren't financed well and they have different issues, and really they kind of scare the large organizations that are out there. And the large organizations that are out there have all of the wealth and they have all the money, and sometimes it's actually coming from the problem people, and other times it's actually coming from our taxpayer-funded dollars. So the slice of the pie, the slice of the resource pie to go solve solutions that grassroots organizations care about really don't trickle down. The trickle-down theory just does not work to the people that actually could do an awful lot of money, an awful lot of good with a very little amount of money if they had some of it.
I'd like to hear Fred's response to that, if I could. Mr. Tupman?
Well, yes, I totally agree. And to reiterate what I was trying to say earlier, too, is that I think that changing the social economic realm, which is frankly responsible for many of the environmental problems, that is very controversial work. If the environmental movement pursues simply cleaning up air and water generically, that's very uncontroversial.
Right.
It actually is work that is not inclined to take on the worst problems that are facing people from a class level.
Yeah.
Changing the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
So what I was suggesting is that it's not attractive, it's not appealing to moneyed groups that rely on big overheads and, impressive offices. not very appealing for them to take up the causes of people who are suffering from class-based environmental problems. Not their problem. It's not their problem.
And let me give the number out again. Feel free to call 202-588-0893. 202-588-0893. Call the News Views and be a part of this. Mark, did you have a comment?
Well, yeah, I'd just be curious, Fred. You know, we're talking about the most serious environmental problems of underserved communities. I assume a lot of it is toxic waste, is landfills, is waste in the water or in the air. And I guess my question is, that is clean air, that is clean water, which you say is uncontroversial. Why couldn't the Sierra Club work on cleaning up the Anacostia River, for example?
Well, I mean, I think they do. I mean, I think Sierra Club in particular does do environmental justice. They have a person in charge of doing that type of stuff. But the mainstream of the money that is raised by the organization doesn't come from folks who support that particular work. I mean, I think it's a credit to Sierra Club that they're doing anything at all on it, but the 1% funders, right, the major donors, those tend to be folks who, again, are worried about, you know, wildlands and, like I said, nature-based places, working on those, again, social, economic problems that have an environmental nexus in many cases.
One of the things, and our last caller, Mike, I happen to know he's an environmentalist, he's waged some very successful battles. And when we talk about the fact that it's class-based and race-based, I happen to know that some of the issues that he's dealt with were where builders were going to come in and take some pristine wetlands and build townhomes and all kinds of things, you know, and just destroy all the wetlands for God knows thousands of acres, and Mike and other people would fight that. But these builders were people who had a lot of money, who might have been donating. Where one of the other things he dealt with was the big box stores, where you had small communities on the bay that were people who had, farmed and raised the local things, etc. And these big Walmarts or whoever were going to come in and disrupt the town. And of course, bringing in all the new roads that had to be built and the new things that were going to be built with them, which was going to bring more pollution, was going to bring more runoff, et cetera, like that. And, I think one of the issues is these are powerful, entities. These were powerful economic entities that many times, you know, are providing money that maybe some of these major groups don't want to offend, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, totally. In fact, you know, part of my work is suing housing developers and others who are involved with bad environmental practice. We've never sued one of those interests that didn't have some environmental presence on a board of directors somewhere. In many instances, these mainstream groups have gone into partnership, right? But part of the role that mainstream environmentalism plays is it protects capitalists, right? If you want big money, if you see a money group that has no trouble raising money, I assure you, they're not fighting the man. That's key, right? So that's very hard, I think, for people of color to ally themselves with organizations that are partners with the very same interests tearing up their neighborhood.
I would just say, we talk about money in Washington all the time, you and me, Garland, and this is really a subset of the larger problem of, you know, them that have the money controls the politicians. I mean, that's the problem with lobbying in general, is that only rich people can afford it, that if you want to fight the National Rifle Association, then you look for a rich man like Bloomberg to fight them. Even though I support Bloomberg's cause, it's sad that it requires a very rich person on your side before you get any justice. And I guess my question would be, you know, to find some rich people that care about environmental justice. Unfortunately, you have to. But there are some of those out there. I'd just be curious to know whether lobbying, what you really think we need to do, Fred Tubman. Do we need to lobby the Sierra Club and NRDC? Do we need to encourage them to look at issues of environmental justice? Do we need to protest? What would you advocate?
Well, I'm trying not to finger point a particular group. Everyone does what they do, and I realize that that all makes some contribution. What I think we have to do also, though, is to make people, help people understand that grassroots work is really where the action is, right? Grassroots work, for a number of reasons, you can't stamp out. It's inherently empowering of the people and the communities involved. It's very democratic. It is not reliant on money, and so it is resistant to coercion from vested interest. And yet the grassroots work is invisible. It's work that is seen as bush league and amateur and unimportant to mainstream groups who are, quote, the professionals. And mm-hmm. We've created an entire professional class of environmentalism who work for money. And so any day of the week, they're likely to make a better decision about their careers than they are about the environment.
And that's true of lobbyists throughout Washington.
And the other part of it here is the other way around, is what's in it for them, for this reason. You know, the mainstream environmental organizations, and again, I'm not, the Sierra Club, the Wildlife Federation, they do wonderful work, and I know people involved. I'm not here to say they're bad. We're saying how they can make it better. But one of the things is this, and I've heard this from people in some fairly powerful left-leaning organizations, and they'll say, well, you know, if we could get the black community involved in this, if we could get the Latino community involved with this, et cetera, that if they want, if you look at, say, the last presidential election, where none of the candidates even talked about the president, they didn't talk about climate change.
No,
they didn't talk about these things.
Not unless they were asked, did they talk about it for a few minutes and
now,
move on.
If the black community and the Latino community, which have become powerful, powerful voting blocks, are involved in the environment, the mainstream environmental movements, then they certainly, you've got two additional powerful voting blocks that can make their concerns about climate change, et cetera, known, because they know that these environmental groups are also working on the, you know, environmental justice issues. This can make a big difference in coercing the politicians to say, you know, if I want to get the black vote and the Latino vote and I want to get elected, I'm going to have to deal with climate change for one thing, because they're pushing my buttons on that too.
Well, Fred, you pointed out that the grassroots movements are secret. No one knows they're going on. Maybe then the answer is, if these national organizations would shine a light on and join with and partner with these grassroots organizations, we could have the best of both worlds.
Well, I agree, and I think there's a tension there. I think there's nothing in it for a large mainstream group to celebrate the grassroots. They can't charge anybody for it. It's inherently not a money enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, it takes a lot of patience and a lot of commitment to deal with community-based concerns as opposed to a slogan. you know, I mean, that's what large groups do. They brand these issues so that you're just working on a slogan. At the end of the day, it's almost meaningless, what I call a MacGuffin. You know, it advances the plot line. It gets people to write checks. what does it really mean, right? What does Save the Bay really mean? Particularly if you're talking to somebody that's nowhere near it, who only sees the bay on the Discovery Channel, if at all. They're upstream, and nobody's interested in working on those local problems that drain downstream, because all the focus is where the money is.
Excellent.
Right?
Well, we have another caller, and a gentleman that I'm very, very familiar with, who I'm very proud of, who does some brilliant work throughout our nation, Reverend Yearwood. Reverend Yearwood, welcome to WPFW.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's so good to be calling. I'm very impressed by this discussion. You know, this is WPFW is an amazing radio station. I go around the country, and I just long when I come back home to D.C. and to hear this conversation. It's so important to hear this going on now.
Well, thank you. And I know you do a lot of social justice work, and we're talking about environmental organizations. But, you know, do you see that also in a broader context in social justice work, of where the groups that should be, or maybe in some way would be concerned with the black community or with people of lesser means, who it's difficult to get them to actually bring diversity to their organization, as opposed to say, okay, we've got this thing we're working on, let's go get the black groups to help us with this, as opposed to saying, let's have African American or Latino people within our organization who are actually helping to make the decisions as to what we're going to address in the first place. Do you see that yourself in your work?
You definitely do, but let me say, it's a very layered process, though. I mean, it's not as easy as black and white, clearly. I think that, yes, I mean, for our overall goal for our progressive movement is that we want to have fairness and justice. And so we know we cannot have a progressive movement that is a segregated progressive movement. Mm-hmm. We can't have the police brutality rally be all black, the peace rally be all white, immigration be all brown, and so forth. We must break down those lines, but also we can't be siloed, which we're hearing on this show, that we can't be a siloed movement in which you have the EJ movement over here and other movements being off to the side. You know, I grew up in D.C. One of my mentors was Damu Smith. Mm-hmm. And also Dr. Ben Chavis with the Hip Hop Summit. So, you know, I came into this process understanding, you know, that dynamic. But I will say this, though. I think it is unfair. And I don't think that environmental organizations are inherently trying to block out. And I know right. there could be some discussion on that. I do believe this. I do think there's a cultural difference on how we organize. There's going to be a cultural difference, even how those of us who are in D.C. would organize different from those who are in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a cultural way and difference. And I think that is also very important. So even how we operate and how we organize and how we mobilize, it will be different depending on different areas in the country. Now, with that being said, I definitely agree with the resource question. I personally, you know, we just did the Ford on Climate rally, which we did on the mall mm-hmm. at the White House. And I know Hip Hop Caucus, along with Sierra Club and along with 350, you know, led that convening with others. But at the same time, let me say this. I think it's very important for those of us from whatever community you come from to work together. And I think we must hold ourselves accountable. I want to hold not just Sierra Club accountable, but I want to hold the Black Church accountable, who's been preaching right. about this and talking about this in their pulpits. I want to hold the fraternities and sororities accountable as well. We must come together because this issue is not an issue about equality, but an issue about existence. If we lose this battle regarding climate change, we lose it all.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Reverend Yearwood. Appreciate your calling in, and certainly, you know, we want to hear from you on a regular basis. Be a part of
that was very powerful. I'd like to particularly like his call out to the Black Church because, to the extent that the grassroots organizations are out there. And that church groups, for example, are taking care of the environment in their own backyards, then people need to contact each other, right? I mean, the national groups need to contact the grassroots yeah. groups. The grassroots groups need to contact the national groups and find out what they can work together because the Reverend's absolutely right. We have strength in numbers. We have strength in coalition. Right. We need to see more non-brown faces at the immigration rallies. We need to see more non-gay faces at the gay rights rallies. Right. We need to see white faces at civil rights rallies for African Americans, non-union faces at union rallies. The point is we all have to work together on all these issues, and united we stand, divided we fall.
And if you look at what happened politically with the coalition that we had that was able to elect President Obama.
Sure.
It's obvious that there is a new coalition in America that's very powerful, and we have to make sure that that coalition comes together to be as active as it can be as a group in all phases, even within the environmental community. I think we've got another call, and I think that would be John. Welcome to WPFW, John.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hi, John.
What I wanted to say was I work in television. I've done a number of segments, particularly on the Anacostia River. And, you know, the environmental catastrophe that's going on in the river is pretty astonishing. You know, one of the factoids that came away from us on one of the segments we did was that the equivalent of 3 747s every month worth of debris is put into the Anacostia.
Wow.
So
yeah.
It's astonishing that, you know, I don't personally believe that we should be looking to or relying on corporations or larger organizations. I really think, as a lot of your callers have said, that it's really a grassroots effort. We need to, as human beings, we need to stop soiling our own nest. We need to mm-hmm. take responsibility for this. Of the two pieces I've done, one was actually funded by the Koch brothers, which was really interesting.
They won't hire you again. that was a one-time offer. I don't think you wrote what they wanted you to, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. No, they're two different things. Well, I don't necessarily agree particularly with the Koch brothers from their political viewpoint, but as sort of, you know, quasi-extreme libertarians, they do have conservation as part of their DNA.
I had no idea. I wouldn't trust it, but go ahead.
I'm not debating. I'm just saying that's just sort of like my research based on what I've done. But when I did one of the videos was with the Anacostia River folks, and they actually, you know, they're people that are passionate about it, and mm-hmm. you know, and I think that is truly a grassroots effort, and I think what you guys are doing to help organize that is really, really important. That we shouldn't like mess up our own environment. We have to take care of it very locally. When I saw the statistics, I was just blown away.
Thank you very much, John. And I think what we're doing here, Mark and Fred, I think what we're doing here is important because this is an issue that isn't discussed. And that's what we try to do, Mark and I try to do here on News Views, you know, is find issues that either aren't being discussed or that we can discuss in a new, unique way. Now, Fred, let me throw this out to you. I think one of the things I'm hearing here, there are two things I'm hearing. I'm hearing grassroots, and then I'm hearing broad, more mainstream organizations. Is it realistic to believe that we can connect the broad mainstream organizations with the grassroots organizations to work together? Or, you know, is it never the twain shall meet? What do you think about that?
I think we have a shot at it, and I think we have a better shot than people might imagine because we have a better story to tell. The story of grassroots is a story of spiritually connected people to land, air, water, and sun. Right? It is a story of a movement that cares about people and communities just as much as it does about science, mm-hmm. right? That the mainstream movement, in my view, and this is an extreme view, I realize, I believe has sucked the life out of this rich, layered subject matter that could be so inclusive by its very nature. It brings people together. Nothing lights up people but the opportunity to talk about their own particular connection, right? When we started the show, right, you talked about your connection to the Potomac.
Mm-hmm.
And this is such a powerful thing that is not being harnessed by a movement that has become obsessive about getting along with the existing power establishment, not disrupting the social economic balance that has created many of these ecological catastrophes, and raising money. Because if you ask most mainstream environmentalists that there's been a good program, a bad one, they will tell you the one that was good was the one that got funded.
See,
that is how blind I think this movement has become to the power of compassion for people as it affects their environmental realm, where they are. That's the environment, where they are.
I'll tell you, here's what I've learned from this discussion. I hadn't quite thought of it, I must admit, in the environmental realm, but this is part of the larger problem in Washington, which is that lobbyists, even things we agree with, not even talking about the things we don't agree with, but lobbyists, even for causes we agree with, exist because of money. Mm-hmm. They finance, they can affect elections because of money. They give money to politicians. They get rewarded based on money. It's still based on money, not based on the works they do. So you can have organizations, it could be the environment. One organization helps the environment, cleans it up a lot, and another one has more politicians in their pocket. Guess which one's going to get funded? Guess which one's going to get all the money? The one that owns the politicians, not the one that actually gets the job done. And that's broader than the environmental movement. There's a lot of complaints on a lot of lobbies, not just on the right, but on the left, that they're more focused on raising money than on actually doing the good they need to do. So to me, this is a very important discussion, but actually part of a larger discussion about how much money controls things in Washington.
Well, I'll tell you something I got out of this show, and that is that groups, whether it's the large environmental groups or whether it's the other, whether there are groups that are large national groups that are working on, you know, single payer or MoveOn.org or all
any
of these other groups that I support, you know, I completely support. Don't get me wrong there. But I think these groups also need to look in the mirror.
That's right.
And they need
group needs to look in the mirror and say, are we doing our cause?
Right.
Are we working to raise money?
And I think they also need to look in the mirror and say, let's look at the upper echelon of this organization and let's ask ourselves, do we have any diversity in the administrative part of this organization? Do we have any people of color? Do we have women? Do we have any variety? Is there any, or is it just an organization that means well and does good, but they don't get a diverse perspective because it's lily white at the top, you know, at the bottom may be another thing, but the people who make decisions, you need diversity there. And I think the powerful left-leaning organizations need to look in the mirror and ask themselves questions. And this is not pointing a finger. This is saying they can be better if they are more diverse.
Well, I wholeheartedly agree. It's not enough to congratulate yourself on not being racist or classist. The real job is to work to defeat racism and classism in your good work.
Well, Fred, we are just about out of time here, but I'm going to have to thank you. I think it's been a brilliant show. We want to keep in touch with you, and we hopefully we'll hear from some of our callers, garlandin@gmail.com. Mark?
Go to my website, marklevinetalk.com. Leave a comment there or follow me on Facebook.
Fred, if they want to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
Pretty easy to find me. Just Google me, Patuxent Riverkeeper. We're easy to find on the web.
Patuxent Riverkeeper. You're listening to News Views. My name is Garland Nixon. I'm here with Mark Levine. News Views is on every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. You know, Mark, we need to do something on organized labor. We need to do something on labor. Organized labor is under attack, and I'm going to put together a show on labor. That's what makes our middle class. News Views, See you next Friday, 6 p.m. Thank you for listening to
Thanks for listening to the just completed Public Affairs or News program. As a listener-sponsored community radio station, WPFW appreciates your feedback, whether favorable or otherwise. To provide your feedback, even if it is regarding one of our many music programs, simply email us at info@wpfw.org. That's info@wpfw.org.
Hi, I'm Jerry Motti, office manager for WPFW. And you are tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum.